The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Danny Schechter is in studio. Hi, Danny.
Hey, Gary. I'm glad to be here. Do you hear me okay?
Yes.
I don't think they were prepared for me to actually intervene in this broadcast, this historic broadcast today. But I'm just getting ready to, you know, have my own program, News Dissector Radio, in a few minutes. And we're going to be starting off, going live to the rally at the scene of the Triangle Fire 100 years ago, where 146 workers, immigrant workers, lost their lives, and it was the spark plug for unionization here in New York. And it was also a really example of the owners of the factories, both of them, got off. It's sort of almost anticipating what's happening on Wall Street today.
Danny, are you, and I hope this audience, I know that they will stay tuned because it's going to be a real history lesson. I hope you're going to bring up the fact that just this past year, I believe it was in December, there were over 37 people or thereabouts killed and hundreds injured in another fire where they were in a building and the fire's doors were locked in a garment industry making place in Bangladesh. And by American corporations that were having their cheaply made products, and these people were making 100 times less per hour today than those workers who died in that fire who won
100 years ago.
100 years ago. Wow. And that's slave labor. So the next time you go to buy an outfit, understand who might have had to suffer or die because American greed and because these people, and I think as progressives and independent, we must stop buying from any company that exploits people.
Well, thank you, Gary, and we're going to move on right now. We want to introduce you to a film that's on HBO. It's going to be on CNN tomorrow night. It's directed by my good friend Mark Levin and with Daphne Pinkerson. And Mark is standing by to talk to us, hopefully, outside the building that housed the Triangle Fire 100 years ago down at NYU. So stay with us now as News Dissector Radio takes over the airwaves here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
On March 25, 1911, a fire broke out in a factory in downtown Manhattan, killing 146 people, mostly young women and teenage girls. And it burned a hole into the conscience of America.
My grandmother, Pauline, worked at the Triangle Waste Company finishing buttonholes. To be a worker under those conditions was to have very few rights.
If people want to know, what would deregulated industry look like? Look at the Triangle building.
Julia Gitlin.
Rose Oranger.
My great-grandmother survived the fire. She watched her co-workers falling from the windows, holding hands.
People really felt the horror of this event, even if they didn't have people in this fire. I mean, spoke to the whole city.
Fanny Lanzner.
Rosie Wiener.
The fire was just the beginning of an all-out assault on big business. The workplace was changed forever.
There you are, the trailer of the HBO film Triangle. And now standing by and with me this morning, one of the great documentary directors, good friend of mine, Mark Levin, who worked on this film with Daphne Pinkerson. Mark, you're down at NYU, I believe, the former site of the Triangle, a shirtwaist factory. What's happening there? There's been a big ceremony today.
Yeah, Danny, I'd say there's it's good to talk to you, Danny. There's probably about 25,000 people that have been down here commemorating the 100th anniversary. The mayor is actually speaking right now. Senator Schumer was here. A lot of the distinguished Secretary of Labor, Solis, is here. So it's quite a ceremony. And I would say, just honestly, looking up at the building as I'm talking to you, I have mixed feelings. On one hand, I think the 146 victims who died 100 years ago would be moved by this tribute and by so much of the progress that was catalyzed by that tragedy. And yet, on the other hand, I think they would be horrified by the attacks we're witnessing against working people, against labor movements, in the last 4 or 5 months. So it's quite moving to be here, and a lot of different emotions.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, this is part of my own bloodstream, Mark, in a way. You know, my father was in the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. I grew up in the tradition of the garment workers here in New York, and the Triangle Fire was something that we all learned early on in life. And you've just finished this film. Just quickly tell us about it, when it's on, because I think it's a must-see.
I appreciate that, Danny. It's going to be on tonight at 6:30 on HBO. It'll be on a special broadcast of CNN, so people that don't have HBO can see it tomorrow night at 11 o'clock at night. And then it'll be on HBO On Demand.
We're going to Media Wars after this, right?
What's that?
No, no, I'm sorry.
And it'll be on demand, on HBO On Demand, the rest of the month.
Okay, well, Mark, I don't want to, I think it, this is a, there was a film on PBS that was very good, but I somehow feel probably yours will be a lot better. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm looking forward to seeing Triangle. Daphne Pakerson, your co-producer there, is also a great documentary filmmaker, and I wanted our audience, I wanted the people who listen to this News Dissector program to hear about this and to honor the 146 workers who died at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire 100 years ago today, and also not lose any of your rage and anger, because the owners of that factory were not really convicted, were they, Mark?
No, they were actually acquitted in less than 2 hours' time, and amazingly, after all was said and done, they actually collected on their insurance claim and, sadly to say, made money on the fire.
It sounds a little like what's happening on Wall Street today. Okay.
I think that's the point, Danny, is, and you know, you've been carrying on for years this tradition, that every generation has to relearn the lessons. And, you know, we've been blessed to have a lot that we take for granted that was really inspired by this fire. You know, when it comes to minimum wage, no child labor, workplace safety, unemployment, health insurance, all of these things started back then, the right to organize. And to think that 100 years later we'd be witnessing such a full-scale right-wing attack on all these rights, it's hard to believe, but it only means that, you know, we got to stand up and fight for what we think is right.
Well, thank you very much, Mark Levin, coming on at the last minute here from downtown New York. 25,000 people honoring the victims and paying homage to the fight that the Triangle Fire sparked, and the fight goes on and continues. Coming back in a minute to talk about the wars in Libya and the wars here in America. You're listening to News Dissector Radio on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. The toll-free number, 877-627-5065. In the studio with Chris and Kat. Sherry Welsh, are you there?
Yes. Hello,
Sherry Welsh in Atlanta. We've got to hold the whole family here together. And please stay with us.
We're going to fix that technical problem.
ABC.
NBC.
CBS.
CNN.
Fox News.
Breaking news.
Faking news. The media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
I worked at ABC News, worked at CNN.
To see so many colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration.
Thank you, sir.
The Pentagon also controls the timing of bad news, the heavy-handed way of managing the message.
Media war.
Managing the message.
Media war.
Well, we're in another media war right now. The country that's in the spotlight is Libya, but the whole Middle East seems to be on fire with uprisings and protests in Yemen, in Bahrain, in Syria, maybe even soon in Saudi Arabia. The world is shaking in many ways, and these conflicts, as they develop, also raise urgent questions about why conflicts can't be resolved, and why do Americans seem to choose war? And I have with me from Virginia, Richard Rubenstein, who's written a brilliant book, Reasons to Kill. It's just come out. He is an expert on conflict resolution, a professor at George Mason University, which has a great program of conflict resolution. In the book, he tells a story about how at the beginning of the Iraq War, he was trying to hold a little seminar at the United States Institute of Peace just to bring together people who were for the war, against the war, whatever, to talk about how the conflict could be resolved. And, you know, they were all very interested until they were no longer interested and the thing never happened. Richard Rubenstein, thank you for joining me this morning. As you can tell, there's a lot going on here in New York, the anniversary of the Triangle Fire, but there's other fires underway in the Middle East. And I wanted to begin, if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Oh, sure. I'm a professor at the School of Conflict Analysis and Resolution at George Mason University, which is the oldest and largest conflict studies program in the country. We've got about, 300 graduate students, another between 200 and 300 undergraduates studying how to resolve serious conflicts, how to analyze them so that we can understand them better, and then use that understanding to develop methods of solving them without getting a lot of people killed.
Excuse me, but in the run-up to this conflict with Libya, I mean, it seemed as if the United Nations was asleep at the switch. There was nobody really talking about conflict resolution. The assumption was we have to go and bomb these people, and Gaddafi is the only language he'll understand, et cetera, and so forth. And, you know, and so the war was on and is still on, although just yesterday NATO took over, but nobody seems to be clear about what they're doing, what the mission is, what the end game is here. It's a complete confused mess. I have a new piece in my blog on mediachannel.org called Theater of the Absurd, and it reminded me of the Theater of the Absurd because there's so much here that makes absolutely no sense
to me. I agree entirely.
But maybe you can tell us why. What happens when a conflict like this is building? Isn't there ever an effort to try to talk to people and try to resolve it before it starts?
Well, you know, I mean, the answer is no. it's really a tragedy. But and I must say, I don't ascribe it to people's bad will or to evil motivations. I think there's an old way and a new way of thinking about things, about this sort of thing. The old way is the kind of power-based way. It's the way empires think, and it's the way people have thought for a long time. People who call themselves realists, although they're really not realistic at all, think about international politics and domestic politics, civil disputes, and so on. They think about negotiating from strength, what they call negotiating from strength. So they see only kind of the old-fashioned way of thinking about these things is that there are two possibilities. One is use violence. You get what you want through using violence. The other, which they think is different but really isn't, is you get what you want by negotiating, by cutting a deal. And negotiating, as it's often done, means instead of pointing your weapon at the person across the table, you put the weapon on the table.
You know,
so
it's interesting.
Everybody can see what you've got.
Particularly
you know.
With Gaddafi, because there were negotiations with Gaddafi. Gaddafi made a deal to basically, you know, cop to the plane sabotage.
That's right.
And in exchange for new trade and deals with the United States. So there
That's
is
right.
a background to negotiations here. But in this particular case, as this conflict jumped up, based on the scantest information I have ever seen, really, it was concluded that this man is a menace and has to be bombed. He was demonized very much in the way that Saddam Hussein was, even worse, you know, ridiculed on every level. He himself didn't do much in terms of PR to try to counter that campaign, or maybe didn't know how to counter it. I'm not sure. But I do know that there was no serious attempt to try to finish it. Now we're fighting on behalf of the rebels. none of whom we know, apparently. I mean, Richard Engel of NBC News was in Benghazi, and he's interviewing the rebels. And, you know, he said, well, why are you fighting? He asked this guy, why are you fighting against Gaddafi? He says, because Gaddafi is Jewish. Hello? Okay? In other words, the understandings on the ground are so different from what we say about what people want. It's just unbelievable.
Well, let me go back to a previous point, just so it doesn't get lost. And that is, because I agree with everything you've said so far, but and that is that people, a lot of people don't understand what conflict resolution is at all. And what it really is, getting people together who represent two sides to a conflict, and they may not be, by the way, they may not be the official leaders. They may not be the people who have the top roles, because for them, they find it very difficult to talk out of the box, and they also these kinds of processes need to be confidential, and they need to be deniable. So you use influential people from both sides, and you get them together not to cut a deal, you know, not to bargain, engage in a bargaining session, but to talk about what's really going on here. What is this conflict all about anyway? What do you really want? What kind of Libya, for example, do you really want? Suppose Gaddafi leaves, or suppose they get rid of him. Then what?
Well, there were two stories today to just kind of counter-narrative to everything we've been told. First, the Washington Post lead story. Gaddafi has the support of most of the people of Libya. Would anybody who has watched the coverage in the last few weeks believe that Gaddafi has the support of the people of Libya? No, you wouldn't, because that fact was sort of selected out, an inconvenient fact. That was one thing.
Well, that's right. And you have to watch the narratives. The narrative, starting with Tunisia, and then going on to Egypt, the narrative, which made some sense in connection with Tunisia and Egypt, was popular uprising against an unpopular dictator. So that on the one side you have the people, and on the other side you have a regime with a very narrow base, and the only people who are really interested in supporting the regime are people who are getting rich off it, or people who are in power, or their cronies. And then you got that narrative, and then you start to apply it to a place like Libya. Well, it doesn't apply to Libya. It simply doesn't apply to Libya. Libya's a civil war.
Yeah, and not only that, I mean, according to Tom Friedman, who has been described as the person who wants to become the mayor of the Middle East, the New York Times op-ed columnist, you know, Tom Friedman said this is not even a civil war. This is a tribal dispute, because that's, you know, who lives in Libya, these tribes, and they're fighting each other. And then yesterday, a report comes out, which is just amazing. You know, Gaddafi has been going on and on about Al-Qaeda, you know, and everybody's saying, what a whack job he is. Why is he mentioning Al-Qaeda? Even my friend Chris in the room here is meditating on this, trying to understand it. His eyes are closed. He can't wrap his head around what this is all about. And then suddenly there's a report saying that intelligence agencies have established that Benghazi, the very place where this rebellion is happening, has been the prime recruiting ground for Al-Qaeda.
Yes, and also what they forget to tell you, too, is that Gaddafi, who, by the way, is not my favorite guy.
Mine. I mean, I'm not here to apologize for him.
But Gaddafi was the first person to recognize the danger that Al-Qaeda posed, and he had an arrest warrant out for Osama bin Laden before anybody else did.
Well, there you go. I mean, I've worked with Nelson Mandela. Mandela was being criticized for being friends with Gaddafi, saying that Gaddafi was his friend. And Mandela said, well, you know, the people in the United States government were not supporting our struggle. Gaddafi was. So we consider him a longtime friend of our liberation fight in South Africa. So don't try to get me to denounce somebody who supported us. He said the same thing about Castro.
Well, that's one of the reasons he's got support in Libya, is that he's a brutal guy, no doubt, in many ways. And he's done some really inexcusable things. At the same time, he's the only leader of an Arab oil country who stood up to the West. And I think what they really have, the reason they really have it in for him is exactly that, that he stood up to them and he said, look, we're going to decide what happens to the oil revenues, not you. You're going to do business in our country on our terms, not on your terms. And we're not going to follow your lead in foreign policy either if we don't feel like following it. And then he produced the Green Book, which, you know, everybody's ridiculing. Most people have not read the Green Book. I have to say, I have read the Green Book.
I have a friend who read it. Yeah, okay.
A friend of mine went to Libya and came back with a copy of the Green Book.
This
and
is his
laid
version
it on
of
my desk, and he
Mao
said,
Zedong's Red Book, a little Red Book.
That's right. He said, "You got to read this." He said, "Because it's in part it's naive, in part it's a little incoherent, but mainly it's a very interesting attempt to try to find a way for Libya." To not go in the direction of either the capitalist world or the then communist world, but to find a collectivist answer for Libya's problems. It represents some actual independent thinking.
So actually, if you go into the whole Libya story and understand it in more detail, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to like Gaddafi, but you're certainly going to get a much more nuanced view of what's happening than we're getting in the media today.
Right. That's right. Plus, it means the whole question of taking sides gets brought up in this, because I was in Malta teaching a course a few weeks ago, and they were bringing in Libyan refugees and so forth. So I got invited to go down to the U.S. Embassy and talk to the U.S. Embassy staff about Libyan conflict resolution. And I went down there and I talked about, look, yeah, this is before the intervention took place. I said, you don't intervene, don't favor intervention. Because here are all sorts of things that can be done to try to resolve this conflict without dropping bombs on people and all the rest. And one of the people on the political staff of the embassy said, but we have to take sides. I mean, the question is, which side are we on, isn't it?
Right. Well, which side?
I said, no, that's not the question. The first question is, do we have to take sides?
Well,
why take sides? Then, if you answer that yes, then the question, which side do you want, and so forth. But that they don't even ask that first question.
Well,
do we have to take sides in this conflict?
Well, point here is there's a term most Americans haven't heard. I'll bet you the two people in the room with me here haven't heard it either. You know, there's a song called "How Sweet It Is." The oil that Libya produces is called sweet oil, and this oil is very important for
sweet crude. Yeah.
Yeah, blending. Sweet crude, you know, blending the other and refining other oils. So it's a very crucial country in terms of the whole oil industry. And so there are clearly reasons why we'd like to get rid of Gaddafi and sort of have somebody in there who's more amenable to our interests on the one hand, you know. On the other hand, the way we're going about it by bombing them, you know, does anybody ever you work in Washington. I can't even stand going there half the time. You know, do these people have any knowledge of history? You know, you bomb Vietnam in the most serious way. It just brings the Vietnamese together. You bomb Iraq. It leads to a resistance against you. Bombing is very ineffective in achieving military goals, and yet that's what they do because that's what they know how to do.
That's exactly right. It alienates half the population. It alienates the other half. It turns into your stooges, and so you're actually perpetuating conflict when you do this. You're not resolving conflict. You're making the conflict worse when you do this. So, and you know, another thing I think you want to watch in a case like this is in my book, "In Reasons to Kill," which is about why Americans have chosen war, kind of why they've been allowed themselves to be convinced, to be persuaded by war hawks of various kinds that it's a good thing to go to war against Mexico, is a good thing to go to war against Spain, is a good thing to go to war against Germany in World War One, and against Vietnam and so forth. Over and over again, there are anti-war movements, and there are people with anti-war sentiments every time, and they tend to get either shouted down or talked down in one way or another. And the reasons that the way this is done is almost always two things are done. One is what the interests of the ruling group are in this country are hidden. Nobody ever says the word oil any more than they said the word sugar, you know, in the case of the Spanish-American War, or that they just said the word territory in the case of the Mexican War. So the interests of the elite are always hidden because they're not the interests of the rest of the country necessarily at all.
Sherry, do you want to jump in here with a question? I'm sorry.
We're steaming forward here,
you know. This is Sherry Welch, Mr. Rubenstein, who's in Atlanta, who works with us on the program.
Hi, Sherry.
Hi, I'm looking forward to reading your book because you write about from the American Revolution to the end of World War II, we spent 19 years at war against other nations. But how many years have we spent since 1950, Mr. Rubenstein?
I don't know, 22 or something like that. I mean, it's more years since 1950 than all of the years put before.
Yeah, most Americans don't see us as a war-making country.
Well, you know, most Americans don't see us as an yet as an empire either. Although I think that consciousness is growing, that this is not just a nation going to war every decade or every two or three decades, and as it used to be in the old days when we were kind of building a nation. This is now a global empire, you know, with bases in more than 100 countries, for whom war is a normal condition.
Right.
We've entered into what, you know, Tom Engelhardt and other people are talking about, a permanent state of war.
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking of, you know, Toys R Us, you know, Wars R Us, essentially. But, you know, one of the things in your book that I really found very stimulating, and this is published by Bloomsbury Press, everybody. You can look him up on Google, Richard E. Rubenstein.
Right.
You talk about, you know, and the person who brought you to me, Mr. Vjost, is a, you know, part of a family. I was great friends with my family years ago, lost touch with them. And, you know, when he told me about you, I said, yes, I'm very interested. Send me the book. Let's get him on the air. And I'm really happy you could be on the air. But one of the things you talk about is, how is it that ordinary Americans, those with the most to lose, are so easily convinced to follow hawkish leaders of both parties into war?
Answer? Yeah, and I think really the short answer is that the leaders take advantage of our kind of religious temper of this people, of the kind of strongly ethical or moral temper, and they sell these wars on the basis of a narrative of good versus evil. So people, if you tell them we're going to war for oil, we're going to war for territory, we're going to war for geopolitical advantage, people will say, you know, drop dead. We're not going to send our friends and relatives in harm's way so that some people can get richer. But if you tell them this is basically a holy cause, and you have to fight it, or you won't be able to live with yourself, then that starts to sell.
Well,
so
if you
look at what they do with Libya, you have two things going. You have innocent civilians allegedly in danger of being massacred. Although, on the one hand, a lot of those innocent civilians they're also the rebels. They're also armed. The rebel group contains elements of the Libyan army. It contains tribal militias, you know, lots of other people with guns. These are not peaceful protesters sitting down in Tahrir Square to begin with.
Good point.
Second thing, they tell you that the people, and this is even more important, that the people who are going to be doing the massacring are evil. And not just evil in the kind of relative sense, as we said before, I'm not crazy about Mr. Gaddafi, and I wasn't particularly crazy about Saddam Hussein, but those people were portrayed not just as nasty nationalists with types, they're portrayed as the devil himself. These enemies are diabolized.
Diabolization. I love that word. Okay.
And that means that they're bad because they're bad. I mean, that means that they have no control. They massacre people because they like massacring people. And they'll come over here and massacre us.
And they will drink your blood if they can get at it.
Absolutely. But people really, whether it's because there's so much belief in the devil in our society, maybe whether that has something to do with it, I really don't know.
I mean, I remember William McKinley, one of our worst presidents of all time, spoke about going to the Philippines to civilize the people who had actually been Catholics for 300 years before he got there. He didn't know that, you know, and so... Here we're in a situation where the people who are leading us don't really know what's going on. The people who we rely on for information, I watched the Ed show the other day on MSNBC. Ed is, you know, he's a real fighter for middle-class Americans and for the working class and all the rest of it. But he didn't know squat about Libya, and he just took the administration line totally uncritical, and in a totally uncritical way, And it was embarrassing, in my opinion. It was just knee-jerk support for the president without asking one question. And what's happening now is that President Obama is organizing a new coalition against him of liberal Democrats and Republicans who feel the Congress has been bypassed, and he can't really explain why he's there, what he hopes to gain. He's trying to get out, his exit strategy, let the Europeans handle it. The Europeans don't know what they want to do either. It is basically an MESS.
That's right. And also, I think there's something else going on with this, too, you might want to mention or think about. And that is this, are they testing out a new formula for Western intervention in other people's disputes? The Americans realize they're involved in too many places, it's costing too much money, even though they're the enforcer. We are the enforcer for anybody else who needs military clout, because we pretty much got it all.
Right. You notice how they were saying, we're just there, Mr. Rubenstein, to enable. We're enabling other countries. Then it turned out the United States was flying 76% of the combat missions in this enabling effort. Now Sheikh Mohammed of Dubai is coming in with a couple of planes, and maybe that's supposed to legitimize this whole effort, which is, absurd on its face. So, we're in a situation where you really have to...
Like taking this Arab League vote seriously, when the great Democrats of the Arab League of the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia and so forth. What a joke.
There was a term that I like to use, but I won't explain right now, that explains all this: mishigas. this is beyond insane.
Right.
That's why I called it the theater of the absurd in my blog today on mediachannel.org and newsdissector.com/blog. Professor Rubenstein, I'd love you to read it and let me know what you think. I'm really impressed with your book, Reasons to Kill: Why Americans Choose War. I'm so happy you could come on at the last minute.
Well, thank you for asking.
I'm very eager to learn more about your work at George Mason University in terms of promoting conflict resolution, which is clearly, a less expensive alternative to this madness, which is already costing hundreds of millions of dollars with no end in sight and with no outcome that's going to be good for anybody in sight.
Well, I've been blogging about this and about some of my other conflict resolution work on, but you don't mind me mentioning the book,
please.
Blog, reasonstokill.com. And there you'll see some more about other projects that we're involved.
Well, there you go. Happy to have Richard E. Rubenstein with us today, a new voice, at least in my mind, for clarity and really a clear understanding of these issues. And we'll be back in a minute.
To chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo.
PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
For the most incisive analysis on the state of our planet from a black left perspective, join me, Glenn Ford, and my colleague Nellie Bailey at Black Agenda Radio, right here on the Progressive Radio Network. We bring you the full scope of reality as we and our interlocutors see it every Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Black Agenda Radio, the place to get oriented to the black left worldview on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, I'm...
I'm Allison Rose Levy. I've been a health journalist for 25 years. I'm currently blogging on the Huffington Post. After more than two decades of studying, talking about, exchanging, and reporting on integrative well-being and collective psychology, I think we're ready to step up to the next level. On Connect the Dots, we're going to reach beyond the merely individual look at health to look at the community, societal, and global level of what we need to address to better our health. Please join me Saturdays at noon Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network, and I look forward to dialoguing with you.
Everyone, this is Richard Martin, host of your bi-weekly wake-up call, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, coming to you live all the way from Singapore. I try to cut through the lies and misinformation to bring you what you need to know to prepare for the economic horrors that lie ahead. I'll give it to you straight in simple language. I don't sugarcoat the news. Unlike the government and media, I have no agenda other than to make you aware of ways in which you can protect yourselves and your loved ones. That's the wake-up call, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. here on Progressive Radio Network.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network, your voice for independent views.
Give me an F!
Yeah!
Give me an I!
I!
Give me an S!
Yeah!
Give me an A!
Yeah!
What's that spell?
Yeah!
What's that spell?
Yeah!
What's that spell?
Yeah!
Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Somehow, some things don't change. And that's Country Joe and the Fish. We're segueing in to discussing what really happened in the 1960s with Ted Morgan, a well-known writer who is a distinguished professor of political science at Lehigh University, author of The 60s Experience, Hard Lessons About Modern America. His book here is about how mass media culture failed American democracy. Mr. Morgan, thank you for joining us today.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
Clearly, this is deja vu all over again for me, having survived the 60s and lived through it, and still, you know, it's still living in me, I have to tell you.
Yes.
It's not something that just disappeared.
Absolutely.
But what I'm interested in is how you went back and looked at the media coverage of the 60s and found that really the violent incidents got all the attention, the real democratic movements and culture that really revolutionized America got very little attention. You want to tell us about that?
Well, yes, I'd say there. What I basically cover is two characteristics of the media, one of which is the boundaries of the discourse, that is, the words that are used to understand and explain what's going on in the world.
Word.
Fall within boundaries that reaffirm sort of the greatness of America, our good intentions abroad, the fact that capitalism works fine, etc., our democracy is working, etc. No questioning of the institutions within the boundaries of the mass media. But outside, of course, there are those kinds of challenges, and that's where most of the movement organizing is happening. And the other quality is partly because of the rise of television in the 50s, the importance of imagery becomes kind of a vehicle through which competing corporations, media corporations, try to grab the public's attention. So you get the rise of more evocative images, emotion-producing
graphics,
drama, et cetera, conflict, personalities.
Graphics, yeah.
Absolutely. So with those two qualities as the way defining how the mass media, the commercial mass media, covered the movements of the 60s, basically everything the movements are saying and arguing for the most part, falls outside those boundaries, civil rights being an exception in the South, but black power.
But narrowly, you know, I mean, it's about segregation.
Yes, exactly.
Not about economic injustice, not about dispossession of people, not about inequality of income. And you know, I was just at the Al Jazeera conference out in Doha in Qatar, okay, which is a very wealthy place. But the head of Al Jazeera starts talking about, like, what they see their mission is, and he says to give visibility to oppressed peoples.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, that's a word that you never hear in American media. Oppressed peoples, you know?
Well, we don't have those in this country.
Exactly, and that's what I'm saying. I mean, how the discourse is driven by a way to compress it, a way to package it, a way to take its content out of it, you know, strip it of content.
Yes, and of course it's only gotten worse over the years since the 60s. More commercialized, more immediate hits, short bites. You know, a tidal wave of imagery, et cetera. So in a sense, then, what I argue is in the 60s, that kind of phenomenon helped to drive the movements apart from the rest of America in both directions. That is, both alienating the movements further or radicalizing people. And on the other hand, providing imageries, texts, personalities that could be easily exploited by powers of backlash and the power of commercial exploitation, which then had kind of took over the way the 60s got characterized in our culture ever since.
To me, the classic example of it is the March on Washington, 1963, Dr. King's speech, which is compressed to four words, "I have a dream." And you just see that same clip, "I have a dream," you know, over and over and over again. And the context that this was a march for jobs and justice is lost. The fact that, you know, he was saying that the Bank of Justice in America was bankrupt.
Yes.
You know, that he was critiquing the society. And somehow that was lost. He became this angelic, you know, figure who is speaking about love and you know.
Right. Peacefulness, get along with each other. Absolutely. And it's interesting that you mentioned that speech because King in the 60s says a lot that's outside the boundaries. When he attacks the war in Vietnam, he gets absolutely reamed by the mass media, the Times, the Post, Life magazine, everybody just
and
calls
also
him a traitor.
And also more conservative civil rights groups who feel he shouldn't have said it, but he did say it, you know, and I think that, you know, in a way he's respected today because he did have independence of mind.
Oh, clearly.
And values that mattered. And I'm just so happy that you've written this book because there are so many things here we can't forget. Sherry and I were talking about it. She was very impressed with it. Sherry, do you want to jump in here?
Yes. Hi, Ted. How are you?
Hi, Sherry. Fine, thanks.
Good. I'm reading your chapter on media culture and the future of democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit more about how we render the media accountable to capitalism and more structurally accountable to the people, especially in the age of the Internet?
Well, I'm not sure about the first part. I mean, the media are accountable to capitalism. What we need to do is make them accountable to us, the people. And there's a lot going on in that front. Bob McChesney's group at the Media Reform Group, the Media Reform Conference up in Boston next month, a lot of effort to try and decommercialize, decorporatize the mass media, because until we do that, what the public is going to get from their primary media source, which is still, for the most people, television, is totally subversive of democracy and empowering the people. It continues to give us a sort of illusion of debate and discourse about our politics, you know, what's going on in Wisconsin and other places. None of the discourse is actually addressing what's causing the problems that we're facing.
Well, you know, it's funny that the leading media critic in America has become Jon Stewart, okay? The Daily Show is doing more to kind of keep the media's feet to the fire. And last night, they went after NBC, the kind of whole idea in which, you know, NBC, you know, NBC News has to keep acknowledging that it's owned in part by General Electric, but never really explains what that means or why that's important.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have these patterns. Now, what is important is that there are other media sources now that we didn't have before.
Absolutely.
And there is a chance to chip away at the dominant, you know, narrative. I mean, when you look at the evening news today, you know, what you see are mostly ads for Cialis. You know, I mean, you know, the generation, it's really aimed, skews older, is how we put it in the media.
Yeah. One study I saw of people getting news from the Internet did indicate, however, that about 70% of the people that use the Internet for news are still using kind of commercialized sources, whether it's actual corporations like CNN or whether it's Yahoo News or Google or some other source. And yes, some of those may have broader access. So there's still this kind of phenomenon and a danger of it becoming even more commercialized.
It's true. You know, the number one source is the Associated Press, which, by the way, is a not-for-profit cooperative made up of newspaper. But it doesn't necessarily mean that the content has the diversity and the range of view that we would like to see. And that's why, you know, I'm doing this radio program on this network, on this unlistened to network, in part because it's important to establish a beachhead for independent media. I've been blogging on mediachannel.org. We started it in 1999. We're still struggling on with it. Sherry's doing an amazing job right now trying to reorganize the material that we have there.
That's why I said the word he should be more accountable to media when actually I read from his book and it's less. I'm tired. But your book is amazing, what you're doing with this, Teddy. Thank you for writing it.
Well, thank you. I just want to get back to the Internet because what you're doing and what so many others on the left and progressives are doing is absolutely vital, and it's so much easier to get access to it. There's almost, overkill in a sense. I mean, I'm going into this stuff all the time. But I think one of the dangers that the Internet provides structurally is kind of the creation of sort of balkanized communities. And that's something I do address in my last chapter, that, you know, we can be people that are kind of all tuning into the similar kinds of sources. And what really has to happen is that we need to get other people who aren't tapping into those resources engaged in the conversation, at least initially with us and then hopefully with those sources as well.
I absolutely agree about that. I mean, you know, one of the things that interests me, you know, is the power. You know, why do people go to the familiar brand? And it's because what's involved in building a brand is a tremendous amount of marketing. You know, when Hollywood makes a movie, half the money goes for marketing, half for making. So, you know, you are at a disadvantage. You can't really compete and become a household word unless you know how to market. On the other hand, we've seen over the last, 10 years, 12 years, all kinds of new brands that we never heard of before. Google, Yahoo, and others emerging as the top brands. Apple, in some ways, being perceived as far more important than just a manufacturer of hardware, in terms of the technologies that enable larger conversations. And the one I just mentioned earlier, Al Jazeera. Here's a network that is 10 years old, basically. You can't even see it in America. And yet it's the number of five best-known brand in the world, and it has a tremendous audience. I mean, I wrote an article on it, Ted. I got 238,000 page views.
Wow.
Okay?
Yeah.
Which is impressive, needless to say.
It sure is. Yeah.
You know, and not because my work is so brilliant, but because they have that kind of reach. And, of course, they're trying to get on the air here, and they're being blocked for bogus reasons because the media industry is scared. The one thing they don't want is a counter narrative. That's why in the 60s, what we created, as you recall, was, you know, alternative newspapers, the Liberation News Service, all kinds of an underground press is what we called it then. And I was part of that, because we understood the way in which the dominant media was hostile to the values and aspirations that we had.
Exactly. I mean, the dominant media, by excluding other points of view, creates an incentive to exit. And so we seek out and find our own communal, convivial communities of interest. And that's not going to work in the long run. We've got to reach other people in the larger American culture. I've always advocated things like community organizing, door-to-door conversations, anything that starts conversations among people that might not be tuned in, but might be sitting there frustrated that what they get on TV is garbage, and the culture is going down the tubes. And
Sherry, you can reveal that you don't have a television.
Good for you, Sherry.
No, I got rid of it two years ago almost.
Yeah.
But, you know,
and that's funny you say it, because I don't read the New York Times anymore. I go to other things like Baseline Scenario, Naked Capitalism, Media Channel, Danny's blog, Rory's blog, other bloggers. I'm getting better news from them than I can from the mainstream media.
And you're not alone. A lot of people are doing the same.
And it's also like hip-hop music, you know. The Public Enemy group, of whom we have a promoter in the room, you know, was referred to as the Black CNN. That the news, that the views that they were presenting resonated with young black people in America who weren't getting it from other outlets and other sources. And you know, of course, the mainstream media were the last ones to really get this.
Recognize it. Yes. Yeah, you know, one of the problems I think that we face then is how then to engage in protest and or organizing that reaches the larger audience. And in the book, I do talk about all the sort of dilemmas that the different movements faced in trying to at least symbolically convey their meanings through the media. And the problem is that the symbols that were often used, very meaningful to the movement, get interpreted the exact opposite way by the backlash artists, and then that sort of feeds the public's perception of people as outsiders, as marginalized, you know, they're not worth paying much attention
to. But, you know,
to.
I mean, I happen to have been, quiet as this is kept, you know, a media consigliere to one Abby Hoffman, you know, who understood not only how to read between the lines, but how to insert his voice of satire and challenge into major media, whether it was wearing an American flag shirt for which he got arrested, or speaking on you know, a number of different TV programs and being banned and all the rest of it.
Yep.
He was able to use media to fight media. And I think that's what we're trying to do now in our own way here at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and the other projects that we're working on. And that's why, you know, Mark Crispin Miller told me, you know, he really was impressed with you and had you at the bookstore there doing a reading. There's a video of it, which you can check out. Ted Morgan, Mark Crispin Miller. Because, you know, I think it's important for us to relearn our history, to re-understand it, not just to, you know, go like with the big name, you know, the Beatles, the 60s, the Beatles, the Stones, Bob Dylan,
sex, drugs, rock and roll.
You're right, exactly, you know, kind of the whole litany of lists. So, I mean, this is something that I think is really important to actually think about and analyze what actually happened in the 1960s and how it was distorted in the media and presented in a way so that to try to stop the message from spreading, to try to stop other people from becoming part of it. And, this is a kind of a media war that we're in now, an information war to get the truth about. We talked about Libya in the first half hour, what we're not finding out about it. And, you know, I think you're writing here. Just wonder, how do your colleagues at Lehigh University, hardly a mecca of radical thought, how do they respond to your work here? How do the students of this generation relate to it?
Well, I very favorably, because among other things, I teach a class on propaganda and media and American politics, and another one on movements and legacies of the 60s. And through those, through a whole course, students really get exposed to a lot of material, including video, significant amount of video, that draws them into understanding in the propaganda class from outside the boundaries, and in the 60s class from inside the movements, what things are about. And they end up saying, example with the 60s class, they end up saying something like, I feel my values are very much like their values. I just don't see any place to plug in well, today's world.
Let me just suggest to you my film, WMD, Weapons of Mass Deception.
Which, I do have it, yes.
Which critiqued the coverage of the Iraq War.
Yep.
And my new film, Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, is really in part about the failures of financial journalism to warn us about the economic crisis and its emerging, the building of the bubble, and the impact that it's had on so many people. So, Ted, listen, thank you so much. But coming on the air with us, we want people to check out this book. It's really important. Who's the publisher, Ted?
The publisher is Kansas, and it's in hardback. It'll be coming out in paper in the fall.
Okay.
And let me just say that if somebody wants to look at the talk on that I gave in New York with Mark Crispin Miller, they should just go to YouTube and plug in the title, What Really Happened to the 1960s. It tends to go by my full name, which is Edward, on the book and so forth. But if they plug in that name, they could find it.
Okay, well, Edward P. Morgan of the J.P. Morgan Chase family. I don't think so.
Wait a minute.
I don't think so. But but listen, thanks so much.
Daddy.
Thanks so much for joining us. This has been News Dissector Radio here on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. We'll have a podcast up on my blog as soon as we get it from Joe the Archivist here in the busy, you know, cauldron of activity here at the PRN. You can write to me at the dissector at mediachannel.org if you want to comment on the show or make suggestions about guests. Hopefully you'll tell other people about the program and stick with us. This is Danny Schechter, your news dissector for another week with Sherry Welsh and the whole team here, thanking you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Kat. Fine, Chris. Thanks, Danny. Bye. Oh, thanks, Matt.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Gary Noel. Thank you, Kat. Thank you. We're going to be, by the way, in New York City in case you're interested, on the 6th of April, April 6th, at the NYU bookstore. I'm going to be doing some work, readings for my book, The Crime of Our Time. So come and check that out, and we'll be back again next week, same time, same station.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold.
When Wall Street stepped into the fold,
Congress paid off workers laid off.
Stanford, AIG, and Madoff.
Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets, empty shops, and bank walking.